Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, August 14th. State health officials are warning of an uptick in cases of whooping cough in Hawaii just as students return to school this month. An audit on $100 million spent to cool public school classrooms uncovers shoddy record keeping. What exactly did taxpayers get for the Cool the Schools initiative? And we hear more about breadfruit or ulu products turning up on school lunch trays. The Ulu Cooperative is expanding its reach. And we celebrate the 90th birthday of our country's Social Security program. Expect to see a skyline salute tonight. And we learn about an ongoing effort to bring homegrown dancers back to Maui. A dance theater's newest show opens tomorrow. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. As you just heard in the headlines, state health officials are reporting an uptick in whooping cough cases, the highest in a decade. As of July 31st, 203 cases have been confirmed. The disease is known as pertussis. Health officials are urging the public to consider vaccinations as a way to reduce the risk of hospitalization and even death. Cases are highest on the island of Hawaii, and the rates are rising on Kauai. Most of the people who have come down with the illness have been unvaccinated or have an unknown vaccination status. The Department of Health confirms there have been several hospitalizations. Ron Balaharia is the immunization branch chief at the Hawaii Department of Health. He spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the ongoing outbreak and shared advice as students head back to school.
If anybody's been coughing for 2-3 weeks, prolonged coughing and just continuous coughing, and we call that paroxysms, where it just continuous coughing, those are the signs. And by that time, it's kind of sort of already too late because you've already most likely infected or spread the bacteria to other people. And so the goal, hopefully, is that we get people to truly realize that this is something that is part of our community, and it is passed from person to person. The message is really to make people understand that get vaccinated, get up to date. But I think part of helping out, besides getting the vaccine and getting vaccinated and up to date, is when you're coughing, cover your coughs. Don't spread germs if at all possible. And it doesn't even have to be pertussis. It could be the cold. It could be any other respiratory diseases that we have. So eliminate or minimize the spread of that cough of those microorganisms, and we can definitely help in really minimizing the spread of those particular diseases.
Let's back up for a second, because at least looking at the information that DOH put out, it seems like this number of cases so far in 2025, and the year's not over, is the highest Hawaii has seen in a decade.
Yep. I would say so, yes. How did we get here?
Yeah,
a very, very good question. Prior to COVID, we were averaging around maybe 46 cases a year. It fluctuated from as high as 50-something to as low as maybe 30-something, right? So we knew we had it in the community, but it wasn't as rampant as we're seeing now. Well, sadly, with COVID, a lot of people then started not getting vaccinated or being misinformed about the vaccine, COVID vaccine in particular, and then sadly has then attributed to other routine vaccinations that we've been really good at vaccinating our community, our young kids and everyone else. And I feel that sometimes that particular pandemic created opportunities for people to not get or question vaccines overall and not get vaccinated. And so then you have a pool of individuals that are what we consider susceptible, meaning that they can get the disease. And as the years pass on, that number grows. And so when a disease like pertussis or anything else, like measles is an example in the continental U.S., those things can spread rapidly in a community that doesn't have a strong or as well-vaccinated community. And so I think that's where we're seeing right now is the years potentially of people not getting vaccinated and also getting into our susceptible community too, are very young. Our newborns are less than 1 year of age, and also our elderly that are also very vulnerable. So once it gets into various groups, by the time people realize it, it's like, oh, shoot, it's too late already because we've already been infected or at least exposed to pertussis bacteria. I think that's where it's come to now, and we're seeing the numbers increasing, and we're hoping that we can try to educate and inform the community that it's something important that we need to make sure we're getting on top of. We can't do this alone here at the Department of Health. We really need the help from everyone because we do have people in our community that are very vulnerable, and so we really want to try to protect them as best as we can.
So whooping cough or pertussis is the P in one of those four-letter vaccines. Exactly. So either Tdap or Dtap.
Exactly.
Those are the two types that people can get. What are Hawaii's rates in terms of how much of the population is up to date with either of those two vaccines?
Yes. Yeah, so the hard part for us is adults, trying to determine what that looks like as far as vaccinations. We don't have a good way of measuring adults at this point in time. We do have a brand new immunization registry that just got online in June. And what we're hoping is that we're going to get better data or collection of data from reporting of various clinics and entities that are vaccinating. And so really looking at that data and looking at population-based data, we hopefully are able to start looking at that number for adults. But that is always going to be problematic. Adults tend to not think that they need it, right? And, oh, I'm strong and I don't need the vaccine because I'm healthy and I can handle it. But where we see most of, majority of our whooping cough pertussis is in our younger population, right? Our keiki. And because of the fact that oftentimes the continuous coughing, they really can't control coughing and breathing at the same time. And for the disease itself, that's why it's called whooping cough, is the continuous coughing. And then when they have the opportunity to breathe, they have that whoop sound. Now, the rates right now, the numbers that we have for kindergartners dip below 90%, and we're slowly rising a little bit close to 90% for kindergarten population. We would like to get that higher, of course, like everything else, at least 95% or above. And again, like I mentioned before, the Department of Health and your private doctor can't do all the work. We really need everybody else, the community and others, to make sure that they're coming in and getting vaccinated, especially their kids.
What kinds of information do you have about the cases? What islands are they occurring on? And whether it's among people who have been vaccinated or unvaccinated?
So we're seeing majority of our cases in unvaccinated individuals. And also when we're dealing with adults, we're also seeing unknown status because they either did not get vaccinated and it was never recorded, or they may have had information, but they just don't have it with them. And so they're considered unknown. But majority of the individuals that we're seeing right now are unvaccinated, unknown status. Majority of our cases that we're seeing are in our neighbor islands. Big Island has the highest number currently right now. We're also seeing numbers increasing in Kauai. So our neighbor islands, we really want to try to get out to them. I think sometimes the concern is, or the issue is, access to having vaccines available. But again, just the sentiment of vaccines overall right now, sadly, is not the same as it was before. But the good thing is that we have a high population of individuals that still get vaccinated, which is great for overall population, but we're not getting to the herd immunity or that level high enough to where we can minimize spread of disease to other individuals.
What proportion of cases have been severe? Have there been any hospitalizations?
We did have a few hospitalizations, and most of it have been in the very young because of the continuous cough. Sometimes the child will stop breathing, part of that is then the parents really concerned and then would bring them into the hospital to have the child checked on. Again, as I said, the younger you are, the more difficult it is for you to manage both coughing and breathing at the same time. And so because of that, sometimes children will start turning blue because they haven't inhaled or taken breath. And so parents are very concerned that something bad is happening to their child, and then we'll bring in their child into the hospital to be checked upon and at least monitored. And if possible, if it's caught early enough, to provide antibiotics to be able to help minimize the severity of the symptoms. So a lot of this is timing. If somebody's been coughing for a long time, then the chances of an antibiotic to help that individual is not as great as if you knew early in the beginning. And that's where we're seeing some of our cases in the very young. Someone in the family has been coughing for a long time, and then all of a sudden it's now to the young child, and then they're starting to cough and then sadly turning blue because they're not able to breathe as normal as possible. And then when they're hospitalized, then they get tested and then we find out it's pertussis, but it came from somebody else close by that transmitted the bacteria to the child.
And we're going into the school year thinking about students returning to schools being in classrooms and close settings. Is there any fear that this could get worse?
I wish I had that crystal ball and be able to tell you what's going to happen. I think we are concerned, definitely, that it will be increasing. Because by the time people finally realize it, oftentimes it's a little bit too late, but they've already spread it to somebody else. And so to your point, one of the things we do want to make sure and emphasize, especially in schools, is, and I know teachers are telling kids, cover your coughs, wash your hands. And if we can continuously keep telling our young kids and have them practice it on a routine basis, not only in school, but especially at home too, really practice those important hygienic practices so that we can minimize spread. And if you're sick, then staying at home and not spreading germs to others that you could potentially get sick.
What role do you think that the current federal administration, particularly Health and Human Services Secretary RFK Jr. and his pretty well-known stance on vaccine skepticism and hesitancy, what role has that played?
It doesn't make our job easy. It just doesn't make our job easy as public health. And yeah, so we really just need to make sure that, again, we can need to continue on with our public, sound public health practices and continue on because of the fact that that's who we are and that's what we represent. We really want to make sure that vaccines are out and people are getting vaccinated appropriately, and then all the measures necessary that are needed to minimize the spread. And so, again, our job as public health workers and people that truly believe in public health to be able to help minimize spread of disease, we want to continue that message because that's day in and day out what we need to make sure happens on a daily basis. And so really wanting to make sure that occurs.
Is there anything else you want to add? Anything you want listeners to know?
Get up to date in your vaccinations. It doesn't matter what age you are. Talk to your doctors, your providers, ask them the questions on if you're eligible or do you have your vaccines up to date. If you are sick, don't spread your germs. Cover your coughs. It's really important that you make sure that you don't spread it to other individuals. There's a lot of susceptible individuals in our community. Oftentimes we don't know if they are, so they're at highest risk. I think one of the things we always say is, let's spread aloha, not germs.
That was the Immunization Branch Chief at the Hawaii Department of Health, Ron Balahadia, talking with HPR's Maddie Bender about the rise in whooping cough cases across the islands. A scathing report of the Department of Education was just released this week by the State Auditor's Office. It looked at an initiative to cool public school classrooms. Here with the story is HBR's government reporter, Ashley Mizuo. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah.
Tell us about this. I mean, because, you know, it's hot out there. Kids are back to school, so it's timely that this report was released.
Right. So I think to kind of start, we have to go back to 2016, which is when the Department of Education got $100 million from the state legislature to install install air conditioning. They had a goal of 1,000 classrooms in 1 year. But the state auditor's recent report showed that the department not only fell short of that goal, but also had some serious lapses when it came to accounting for where these funds went exactly. In total, the auditor's office says that about 800 classrooms actually got some type of air conditioning installed, and it cost about $105 million. Here's State Auditor Les Kondo.
I thought it was going to be a very straightforward, very quick report, because my expectation, or our expectation, was that the department was going to be able to provide us with a straightforward accounting of how the funds were spent, including the number of classrooms and the number of schools that were cooled under the initiative. But the department wasn't able to provide us with that accounting. Right? They weren't able to provide us records. The reports that they gave us were inconsistent. They were contradictory. They included different number of classrooms, different schools, different dollar amounts.
You know, one of the main issues when it came to getting these types of documents to the auditor's office was the person in charge of this program actually retired from the department in 2017 and then passed away in 2022. So that's one of the reasons why the Department of Education said it was very difficult to really get a full accounting of what exactly happened with this project. You know, outside consulting firms made it really difficult to get contracts and documentation to the auditor's office. And the Department of Education provided conflicting documents at the start when they were asked for how many schools were air conditioned through the initiative. You know, according to the report, the department installed solar air conditioning systems that often needed extensive repairs and just didn't work. It cost on average about $120,000 per classroom to install these types of air conditioning units. And solar was really selected for two reasons. One was that the department was mandated to be net zero energy usage by 2035. And then also the electrical grids of the schools couldn't really handle the full capacity of regular air conditioned units because the schools here are very old, and so they're operating right on these older electrical grids.
Yeah, and how many times have we seen them come in with an emergency bill to pay the power?
Right. And they don't want anything like catching a fire, blowing up, or whatever. So the classrooms could only run the AC units for 5 hours at a time. And then if they submitted issues about the air conditioning units, if they had actually run it for more than 5 hours, that case would then be closed without checking on the actual issue of the AC. It was found later that many of those units actually just didn't even work from the start. And, you know, one instance at Castle High School in Kaneohe, they installed the PV photovoltaic panels on a portion of the roof that is completely covered by a shade of a tree canopy, you know, despite people at the school warning that it would not work if they did that. You know, after all of this happened in 2019, parents and community members started donating window units to school classrooms. But it also wasn't clear if these older electrical grids at schools could handle installing all of these different window units. So the DOE tried to standardize a program by doing evaluations on schools' electrical grids that wanted to install these window units, but didn't really do any follow-up. So it's really unknown what units got installed and what didn't. And ultimately, the department ended that program in 2024. You know, meanwhile, I spoke with the Hawaii State Teachers Association president, Osa Tui, and he says, you know, many teachers and students are still stuck in these hot classrooms. He said teachers are blowing like 20 fans at once in classrooms because it's so hot. And he encouraged the Board of Education that oversees the Department of Education to ask more questions. And his concern was that if the legislature sees this type of, you know, waste happening, there'd be less willing to give the department funds that it needs to address its many pressing issues.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that most of the money went to power schools on the west side, Oahu's west side, and there was like one on the Big Island.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Tui reminded parents that they should send their children to school with cold water and ice in a water bottle to help them keep cool as they go back to school.
Okay, yes. Hot days ahead. But thank you so much, Ashley.
Thanks.
That was Ashley Mizuo talking about a recent report of the Cool the Schools program. You can check out her stories at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Our backyard quiz today was inspired by the recent headlines that Matson will stop shipping electrical vehicles to Hawaii. This comes after a ship carrying 3,000 electric vehicles caught fire off the coast of Alaska and then sank. The disaster caused an estimated $560 million in losses. Peixia, another major shipping company, will still transport electric vehicles to the islands with its fleet. We took a deep dive into the names of some of the Peixia ships that transport vehicles, containers, and other cargo. Two ships in the fleet are named in honor of the late parents of Peixia Hawaii's president and CEO. The vessels' names are George III and Janet Marie, but the company uses two other ships to transport electric vehicles. One is a pure car and truck carrier, while the other is a combination container roll-on, roll-off vessel. For today's quiz, can you tell us the names of the two vessels that ship electric vehicles? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right scores an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
People on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program will no longer be able to buy sugary drinks in a dozen states. It's a part of the Make America Healthy Again campaign led by Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
If you want to buy a sugary soda, you ought to be able to do that. The U.S. taxpayer should not pay for it.
Will the ban convince people to consume sugary drinks less? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Pacific Health with tips to help keep keiki healthy. Parents can see if their child's immunizations are up to date by speaking to their child's doctor or checking their online medical records.
This morning, we have breadfruit or ulu on our minds. Overstory Hawaii has a feature by Noel Fuji'i Oride about the ulu cooperative. Good morning, Noel.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and it's amazing how far this co-op has gone.
Yeah, so the ulu cooperative is, they're about 9 years old now, and they actually have just under 200 members on four islands. And the way it works is that the members are the owners of the business. So the cooperative is a business, and the members have a say in how the organization is run. And in terms of operations, the co-op buys their members' harvest. They process the ulu to extend its shelf life. So sometimes that's steaming and then freezing. Other times it's turning it into more value-added products like hummus or like ulu flour. And then the co-op is also responsible for doing all the sales and marketing. And so that really gives its farmer members a really stable market to sell their ulu to and also stable pricing. And with ulu, it does have such a short shelf life. So after you pick ulu, it can ripen in like, I think it's 3 to 5 days. And so that makes it really hard for farmers to sell, or that did make it really hard for farmers to sell their ulu on their own. They had to move it pretty quickly, and sometimes that wasn't always possible, given that ulu hasn't been a super commonly eaten crop in recent decades.
Well, you know, I grew up eating ulu, and I enjoy buying the frozen ulu from the cooperative, and I put it in my curries, but I enjoy it.
And, oh, yeah, that sounds really good.
And I know that there was a lot of hope about funding for the program to expand the program, but some of that federal funding has been cut.
Yeah, so the ULU Cooperative, they had an expanding agroforestry project. It was federally funded, and this was actually part of a much larger national project, but for Hawaii, it was expected to bring about $6 million in for local farmers, and it was for them to either start or expand their own agroforestry production. So the co-op was working with farmers to get them ready to accept that funding, and it was incentive funding, right? So they would have gotten most of the funds up front as opposed to reimbursement. So working with them to design what their agroforestry systems would look like, do financial projections, and just provide other technical assistance.
Well, you know, your article talks about how even with the setback, that the cooperative plans to expand.
Yeah, so the co-op on Hawaii Island, they have their own processing facilities. On the neighbor islands, they tend to partner with other organizations when possible who already have processing facilities. So on Kauai, they're actually opening a new facility just outside of Lihue at the Pineapple Store, and that'll be in partnership with a Kauai business called Resi Roots Cafe. And so they're actually moving in a lot of the equipment as we speak, but they're hoping to open later this month if possible, and they'll be able to process, I believe it's 1,000 to 3,000 pounds of ulu a week. And Kauai actually has the second highest number of members for the co-op after Hawaii Island.
Oh, that's interesting. Really?
Yeah, I was surprised.
Well, you know, I know that they were looking for volume so that they could produce ulu flour as an alternative, you know, on the market. And now they're doing amazing things and getting products in our schools.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's actually a really great point, because by aggregating all of their nearly 200 members ulu, and by the way, they also do process other crops, so kalo, uala, and pala'ai. And so having this aggregation and doing the value-added processing, it's really created a year-round supply of ulu production. And that's enabled them to, in turn, be stable for other buyers, right? Whether it's restaurants or whether it's larger institutions like the State Department of Education.
Yeah, no, it's a fruit that is becoming more popular, and we've got to get more customers out there focused on the many things you can do with ulu. I was very surprised to learn about the varieties. You know, I grew up with ulu, but I just did not know there were so many.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Yeah, so it's a fascinating crop, but it's got a bright future. Well, thank you so much, Noelle.
Yeah, thank you, Catherine.
We've been hearing from Noelle Fuji'i Oride, the editor of Overstory Hawaii. You can find her article at overstoryhawaii.org.
It's time to laugh at the headlines live. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is coming to Honolulu October 9 and 10. Get your tickets now. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org/waitwait. Sponsored by Honolulu Financial Partners and Hawaii Pacific University.
Today on The Daily, The New York Times ranked the top 100 movies of the 21st century. Here's what actors, writers, and directors had to say about them and why they matter. I'm Natalie Kitroeff. That's Today on the Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30, following Marketplace.
Thank you.
This morning, a celebration at the Lanikila Multipurpose Senior Center included cake to mark the 90th anniversary of this country's Social Security program. Members of our Hawaii congressional delegation were invited to the party, and we got the chance to talk to Kealii Lopez, head of AARP Hawaii, about what many consider a lifeline for so many of our kupuna. Here's Lopez.
In Hawaii alone, it's lifted 49,000 puna 65 and older out of poverty every year. So it's a critical program. AARP is wanting to celebrate and bring attention to it, mostly because also within as a short few years, as we talked about on your last show, the trust will be running out of its reserve. Again, want to make sure people know payments are still going to be made. However, protecting Social Security is an ongoing issue that we cannot really rest easily to assume it's going to be something that's available for years to come. But again, AARP and our congressional delegation are fighting really constantly to try to find ways to make sure that Congress pays attention to this issue.
And when we last talked, there were concerns about potential cuts to staffing because of the prolonged wait times on the phone. And, you know, I had shared that when I went down to the office back in February, that I came across someone who had been on the phone for 5 hours. It was a nurse, and she was on the phone on behalf of a terminally ill patient. And so, you know, just the kinds of things that people need to know about wait times and where to report problems, those kinds of things are all key.
And Catherine, thank you for bringing that up, because I think it's important for people to understand that our Congress members and AARP can help if we know about the issue. So folks who are listening, if you have had challenges like those long phone calls or what we heard in the past, people waiting 2 hours and then getting disconnected, please, in our conversations with our congressional delegation in Hawaii, Senator Schott, Senator Hirono, Representative Tokuda, and Representative Case, they want to hear from their constituents if they're having problems contacting Social Security. And that includes accessing their website. So please reach out to them. But also, AARP Hawaii, we want to hear about your stories and ask you to email us at hiaarp@aarp.org. Because again, those issues are something that we're keenly aware of. I don't know if folks know there was a potential effort most recently to change some of the requirements again related to people having to come to offices rather than being able to contact folks via the phone. That was an old issue that came back again. AARP jumped on that right away and Social Security backtracked on that. But that's something that we're constantly paying attention to. But again, unless we hear from people that they're experiencing this problem, it's difficult for us to know what all is happening.
Yes, and they are sending a lot more people online because you can't just walk into the offices downtown in Honolulu anymore. You've got to make appointments, and it may take a while to get appointments. Or like I said, if you're having problems online,
exactly.
It's critical that the people who have access know about it.
Exactly. Not all our counties, you know, if you're on Molokai or Lanai, or if you live in Kona with the Hilo office, and also, as we know, some of the Maui offices are staffed by people in Honolulu. So we will we'll see if we can get information and get that to you, Catherine, about whether there have been reductions in staffing for Hawaii. But again, the big thing for us, Catherine, is getting folks to recognize the importance of Social Security. As an example, if you don't mind me just going into this, a new AARP survey, 6% of Americans see Social Security as very important, and there was no difference from age group or political affiliation. And so it's clearly very important. But if you have a moment, I'd love to tell you what I've been hearing when we've had a couple of our events throughout the state.
Yeah, what was the feedback?
So what we're hearing, we did a show of hands. And of course, a lot of our members, most people were on Social Security, but when we asked them if they thought Social Security was going to be around for their children and grandchildren in a room of over 150 people, Catherine, I saw maybe 3 or 5 hands raised. And that's consistent with AARP survey that said basically people's confidence in Social Security has declined 7% from 2020. So that went down from 43% to 36%. The importance behind that is that, in fact, it will be around for our children and grandchildren if people get involved. One of the things we want people to do is to go to aarp.org/weearnedit. It's a pledge to fight for Social Security. Again, Catherine, you and I have been around for a little bit. In the 80s, Congress had to take a look at this before. And so Congress needs to address this. It's estimated that in 2033 or 2034, there could be a reduction of 20% in what people are receiving in payments. And that's a drastic cut when the average monthly payment in Hawaii for Social Security is almost or not quite $2,000. So that's a pretty significant drop. So that's what we're seeing is people just don't think it's going to be around. And we don't want them to think to themselves, geez, let's just throw up our hands and imagine it's done. People need to contact their congressional delegates, sign up on that pledge, and continue to push hard to have our representatives, in fact, ensure that Social Security will be there for our children and grandchildren. And that's what AARP's been fighting for.
I guess we are all watchdogs, right? If we believe in this program, you've got to make sure that if there are any changes, that you're tracking it and that people in the know have that information, the best information. And I know right now that they do have a website where you can look at the, what the average wait times are, right, on calls and lines.
Yeah, and if you go to socialsecurity.gov.
And they have improved, I think, but just have to be on top of it all the time. Anything else that you think would be important to underscore? I don't know if you have any future sessions coming up.
We definitely are doing a celebration on the 14th itself with several members of our congressional delegation. Senator Hirono Schatz and Sakuta are going to be there. We did an event with Representative Case at the Ala Moana Hotel. He did a fabulous job. And we've done events throughout the state, kind of ice cream socials. So people have been coming for a scoop of ice cream and a scoop on Social Security. I guess the main thing, Catherine, is that for people to understand that about 1 in 5 people in Hawaii, that's 296,000+ people, get Social Security. Whether they're a child of a parent who's passed, someone with disabilities, a kupuna who's retired. It's just a wide range of people who depend on Social Security. And sadly, about 28% of those on Social Security rely on it for 50% of their monthly income. Another 12% rely on it for 90% of their income. Again, if you can imagine a little less than $2,000 being 90% of your income living in Hawaii, that's not going to get you very far. But that is still a lifeline that people have available to them. And the thing that's wonderful to think about is in its 90 years, Social Security has never missed a payment. 90 years has never missed a payment. We want to work with your listeners and the people of Hawaii to make sure Social Security is around for many decades to come.
All right. Okay. Thank you so much, Kaylee. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Catherine. Anytime.
That was Kaylee Lopez, director of AARP Hawaii, talking about the nation's Social Security program. Today marks 90 years since it was signed into law. And to help mark the anniversary, cities across the nation are being lit up in red and white lights. Here in Hawaii, Honolulu Hale and the Maui County Building will be lit up in a skyline salute to Social Security. Now it's time to roll on and roll off the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you a bit about Peixe Hawaii. The California-based company has ties to the island stretching back to World War II. Peixe was formed in 1999, and the company's first vessel set out on its maiden voyage in 2005 from San Diego to Honolulu. Many on the continent knew Peixe from its land-based auto transporters. The company operated a fleet of more than 100 transporters known as the Green Machines. With the recent news that Matson Shipping Lines will no longer ship electric vehicles to Hawaii, Peisha's two vessels are the only transporters left. We asked you for the names of these two ships. We were looking for the Jean Ann and the Marjorie C. The names also have a family tie. Jean Ann was George Peisha III's mother, and Marjorie Catherine Ryan was the grandmother of current CEO George Peisha IV. And that's our quiz today. We stumped you, so we don't have a winner. But if you have a quiz to share, or if you have thoughts on the recent electric vehicle shipping news, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
In his epic composition, The Lightbringer, Hawaii Symphony composer-in-residence Michael Thomas Fumai portrays an epic battle between good and evil. Tell me, what was the genesis of this piece, The Lightbringer?
Well, this is a piece that really starts with the title, The Lightbringer, and it has to do with the devil, an unsavory figure in Christianity, and it is something I was always very interested in because I was brought up Catholic and read Revelations and, you know, was kind of trying to picture the genesis of what would become the devil. And so I wanted to write music that really foretold this battle of the angels that we see in that chapter of the Bible. And that's what The Lightbringer is.
Stand firmly on the side of good by supporting 24 hours of classical music each and every day on HPR2. Visit HawaiiPublicRadio.org to donate.
You know, for the past decade, Maui's Adaptations Dance Theater, or ADT, has been bringing it home. It's a summer residency program celebrating Maui-grown talent. The idea was to entice professional dancers and choreographers who grew up on the island to return home. The troupe's dance concert, Bring It Home, opens tomorrow at the EL Theater in Wailuku. Co-founder and artistic director Haley Hunt spoke with the Conversation's Lillian Song in between rehearsals.
For somebody who's just learning about you, who's maybe new to Maui or not in the world of dance, how did you get the name Adaptations?
Adaptations came from our co-founder, Amelia Nelson. We started over 12 years ago, and there wasn't another dance company to sort of follow in the footsteps here, and we knew we would have to be constantly adapting and changing and growing and ready for anything that was sort of thrown at us. And that has definitely been true. We've had to adapt a lot as we move through all the growth and changes in the past 12 years. So it ended up being a really fitting name.
This community of dancers, you found your own tribe here with that vision to really sustain the passion, the power of dance, letting new generations feed into what you're doing. Talk about the Bring It Home performance concert.
Yes. So Bring It Home is about bringing back dance artists who grew up on Maui, and we want to have them return to share with their community. It's also about bringing back energy performers to share with our community, so it doesn't necessarily need to be someone from Maui. So we have returning Maui dancers, and we also have guest dancers. So we have a guest choreographer, Charlotte Griffin, who's coming to us from UC Irvine. She's creating one of the works that'll be presented August 15th, 16th, and 17th. And the idea behind Bring It Home is to allow the community, and especially the young dancers growing up here and taking class every day, to see what a creative life could look like, to be inspired and get an idea of what they could become in the next, you know, 5, 6, 7 years by seeing that potential version of themselves on stage right here in their community at the EL Theater.
It could be your cousin. It could be my neighbor's daughter. When you see that happening, it gives me the sense of, if they can do it, well, so can I. How are they making it happen?
Absolutely. And to see people from your own community performing feels really different. It feels closer, and it feels more accessible, like it's something you could do. And then you can ask them questions. You can figure out how you could make it happen for yourself. What does that life actually look like. And it is a great life. It's a great choice for a life, to live a creative life.
What is that pipeline that feeds into ADT?
A lot of the dancers with ADT work at different schools on Maui, at Momentum Dance Maui and Alexander Academy. For us, even though we interact with a lot of the young students here, our youngest program right now is Pivot, which is for collegiate age dancers. And Pivot is a fully funded fellowship program. So there's no tuition costs, which has been a game changer for those attending. We run an apprenticeship program also. So our most recent apprentice is now fully in the company, but I started teaching that young woman when she was only 14 years old. So that relationship building happened very young. And then she joined the apprenticeship program, went through the Pivot program for several years, and is now in the company. And that's how a lot of the becoming a part of ADT works. These are people that were in the Adaptations Dance Theater orbit for a long time. They were, you know, born and raised on Maui, went to MAPA or Alexander Academy. Or for Ali, my executive director, and I, we met at a summer program in San Francisco when we were 13 and 14 years old.
And Ali is a product of Maui.
Yes. So Ali McKeon, the executive director for ADT, is from Maui. And her mom, Kathleen, taught at MAPA. And Ali's little sister, Emily, also works for ADT. And Emily is the co-director for Pivot and will be the lead choreographer for Pivot this year. So they're all a part of the organization in a way.
Mm. Okay, Hallie, also, I was quite excited when you mentioned this earlier. There is an opportunity if you're Keiki and Kupuna. Tell me more about that.
So ADT is so grateful to a nonprofit here on Maui called Wave of Harmony. We've partnered with them to provide free tickets for Keiki Kupuna and those facing financial barriers who would like to come to our show. So when you go to purchase tickets or get tickets online at MauiOnStage.com, you go to select ticket type, and when you scroll down, you'll see Keiki/Kupuna provided with Aloha by Wave of Harmony. And if you select that, it'll just zero out the ticket price and allows you a free ticket to the show. Wave of Harmony really believes that part of arts education is being able to see art, to see live performance, which is something ADT absolutely believes in as well. So we're really grateful to them, and they're providing 50 free tickets total, and there's plenty left. So we would love folks to take advantage of this wonderful offering.
Mm. And the concert is also premiering three new contemporary dance works, including a piece that you, the artistic director, choreographed. Tell me more about that.
Yes. So I'm so grateful to be choreographing an original work on a cast of six dancers. Two of the guest dancers, or three, are coming from New York. One is a returning Maui resident, and then three resident dancers. And I've known all of them for a long time. So it's been really fun planning the work, because I feel like I know their personalities and their strengths. And I've been able to really think about what I can bring for our audience. So the piece is entitled Party Animals, and it's kind of about living a creative life and a life of performance. And it has a lot of fun costumes and props, and it's very rambunctious. There's a lot of different musical tastes represented. There's explosions of irreverent joy. There's moments of very sweet tenderness. It's quite athletic. There's going to be some surprising moments of things falling from the ceiling. And I've had the most tremendous time with these people in the studio. I am consistently surprised. I will be, just every time we run a section, I'll be watching the same person and absolutely invested in what they're doing. And then the next time we do it, my eyes will be drawn to someone else, because they'll be doing something so hilarious that I've never noticed. They're really a remarkable cast. They can be beautiful, flowing, gorgeous movers, and then absolute comedians and hilarious the next moment. So their range of what they can do is really tremendous and impressive. My piece is quite wild, and I hope folks will enjoy it and come to see it. Another work that we're sharing is by our guest choreographer, Charlotte Griffin, and she is fantastic. She's a very caring, kind choreographer. She has been wonderful with our dancers, and she pushes for very physically demanding choreography, and it's to this tremendous piece of music. I can't wait for people to hear it. I'll let it be a surprise. It's so exciting. It hits you in a really impactful way. I think it's going to be quite moving for people. So it's radically different from my work. There's quite a difference, which I think is nice for a show lineup. And then the Pivot Fellows are going to be led by Emily McKeon in a new work. They have a very compact, short process, which is really fun and exciting, going to be thrilling.
As an audience member, just knowing that the people on stage, you're all professionals.
Yes. Yeah, so Emily most recently has been dancing for a company called Salt, which is a professional contemporary company in Utah. And that's also where one of our dancers, Joey, had been. And then he has now been freelancing in New York. And Joey and Claire work for a company that they are the directors for called Abodanza. That's also in New York. Maddie McCain, who's from Maui, has danced for a company called The Creature. And then our resident dancers are here with ADT. The cast is small. It's just six of them.
As a co-founder, working from the ground up, seeing the changes, the growth of your troupe, could we liken it to your baby?
Yes. I mean, it feels like that at times just because of the growth and the change. Absolutely. It feels like a baby. And now it's a child. Yeah. You know, it's like it keeps growing and getting bigger and bigger. And then the challenges continue to grow with it. But also the payoff gets bigger because you're affecting more and more people. So I think we're seeing that more and more, which is nice. But yeah, it was definitely a big goal and choice to make. And I think if I'd known, I think I wouldn't have tried to do something like this anywhere else. The community here is so kind and welcoming and supportive that it allowed us to do something so risky because of the place we are. So it really feels like place-based work because Maui's been so receptive to it. And I feel like the community wants to have a dance company. So even though it's been hard, it's been with open arms.
And there is no other professional contemporary dance on the island.
That's right. We're the only professional contemporary dance company on Maui right now.
Hallie, you've been great. Is there anything that you would like to underscore, make sure our listeners know about it?
Oh, just that we would love to have them attend the show August 15th, 16th, and 17th at the EL Theater. If you can't attend, please head to our website, adaptationsdancetheater.com, to learn more about us. And then very exciting news, thanks to the County of Maui and their support, we will be able to offer another Bring It Home in the spring. So look out for that if you can't come in August.
That was Hallie Hunt, Adaptation Dance Theater's Artistic Director, and HBR's Lillian Song. The nonprofit's mission is to create career opportunities for both local and returning artists through apprenticeships and residency programs. The show, Bring It Home, runs August 15th, 16th, and 17th. And those 50 free tickets for Keiki and Kapuna provided by Wave of Harnavi. We will have links on our website later today. And we should note that Adaptation Dance Theater is on our underwriter list. Well, that does it for us for this hour. Tomorrow, we have a Hanaho show lined up for you, Athletes on the Move. We do welcome feedback. Call or talk back line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.